Hello and welcome to another edition of the Byron New York Show, the No Chit Chat Podcast. But like the last time, I have to give you one little bit of chit chat, which is, sorry if I sound a little raspy at times, really bad hay fever season in Washington, so here we are. All right, today we're brought to you by ExpressVPN. We'll have a little more about that in the in a few minutes, but first I want to get right to it, and it's kind of a press extravaganza day. I want to talk about two things. The first, I want to talk about the press performance at this much ballyhooed Joe Biden news conference on Thursday, and then I want to talk about a really extraordinary situation that has not gotten enough attention, which is a lawsuit filed by Project Veritas, the conservative activist group, against the New York Times, which a lot of people might have assumed would just be thrown out of court. It has not. A judge has allowed it to go forward for some really, really interesting reasons. So we'll get to that in the second half of this podcast. But first, let's talk about this the news conference. And I think the only thing you can say is it was an embarrassing day for the White House press corps. There was this huge buildup before the news conference. Why had President Biden waited 64 days to meet the press? Was he going to make some Biden-esque gaffes? He wouldn't be Biden if he didn't do that. What would he do? Well, first of all, his performance was what it was. Biden was Biden. He did handle some questions competently. He wandered around, seemed to get lost on others. He seemed most energized when he blamed his predecessor, that would be President Trump, for the mess at the border that his own policies have created. He stonewalled the press on the question of when he would let reporters, and the nation, by the way, see these overcrowded pens in which his administration is keeping illegal border crossers who are unaccompanied minors. He said, quote, this is a real quote, "I will commit to transparency as soon as I am in a position to be able to implement what we are doing right now." In other words, you'll see it when we want you to see it. When it's all ready, when it's all fixed and nice, then we'll let you see it. But look, his performance wasn't the worst thing in the East Room of the White House on Thursday. The White House selected 10 reporters to ask questions. Those reporters ignored major issues. They failed to follow up. And in at least one instance, attempted to flatter Biden in a performance that just added up to an embarrassment for the White House press corps. So the big omission, and it was really huge, the reporters did not ask a single question about the COVID pandemic. Not one. Not about vaccines, not about masks, not about economic effects, not about schools opening. Nothing. There was no explanation for it other, perhaps, that the reporters who were selected to ask questions were remarkably out of touch with the American people, who consistently list the pandemic as the most important issue facing the country today. There are lots of polls that say, in your opinion, what's the most important issue facing the country today? For the last year, the answer has been the COVID pandemic, plus related problems, economics, schools, things like that. And Biden even began the news conference with a statement about his pandemic policies. The reporter's lack of interest was, what would you call it? It was inexplicable. Go to the Politico story about this. The headline was, this is a quote, "Biden meets the press and the pandemic disappears." Now, just as bad as that. Some of the reporters failed to follow up their questions. They failed to challenge the meaning of Biden's answers. They failed to challenge Biden at all. So there were a lot of questions about the filibuster, about the Democratic drive to eliminate the filibuster. And they were all asked from this kind of, why don't you do it standpoint? In other words, from the standpoint of the left wing of the Democratic Party. Reporters completely failed to probe Joe Biden's earlier support for the filibuster. Why does it appear to be changing now? So Let's look at an exchange between Caitlin Collins, who's the CNN White House reporter, and Biden. I'll give you a dramatic reading of it. Collins, regarding the filibuster, at John Lewis's funeral, President Barack Obama said he believed the filibuster was a, quote, relic of the Jim Crow era. Do you agree? President Biden, yes. Collins, and if not, why not abolish it if it's a relic of the Jim Crow era? Biden, there's a long pause, and he says, successful electoral politics is the art of the possible. Let's figure out how we can get this done and move in the direction of significantly changing the abuse of even the filibuster rule first. It's been abused from the time it came into being by an extreme way in the last 20 years. Let's deal with the abuse first. Collins says, it sounds like you're moving closer to eliminating the filibuster. Is that correct? Biden, I answered your question. Okay, so that was the exchange. Now, from a repertorial standpoint, it was really an astonishing exchange. Because one of the things reporters probe is why a public figure has changed his position, if he has changed his position. The principles of the last two Democratic administrations, President Barack Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, they all served in the U.S. Senate. All of them embraced the filibuster. Now, Harris is the most recent senator. She embraced it last year. Obama embraced it when he was a senator. He even voted to filibuster a Supreme Court nomination. It was Samuel Alito, back when that was allowed. And Biden used it many, many, many times in the 36 years he served in the Senate. I think at the press conference he may have mentioned having served 150 years in the Senate. That was a joke, but not a really huge joke. So anyway, you have all of these top Democrats embracing the filibuster up until virtually the present day. Now that could, in an inquiring reporter's mind, lead to a question. What about you and your Democratic allies, Mr. President? But it appears no one among those who were selected to ask questions thought about it. Okay. I was on a special report on the panel on Fox News on Thursday evening, and so was Trey Gowdy, the former Republican representative. And he was just driven to distraction by this. And I'll give you just a brief quote. What a perfect follow-up question. This is Trey Gowdy talking. Was it a racist relic when his vice president, that's Kamala Harris, used it less than a year ago? Was it a racist relic when you used it, Mr. President? Now, Trey Gowdy was suggesting the obvious and necessary follow-up questions that were not asked. And it wasn't because Biden didn't allow follow-ups. He actually allowed a lot of follow-ups. It was just not asked. So finally, that's that. Finally, one more thing. The fawning. Now, there was one particularly interesting example in which there was intense flattery of the president, which actually ended up backfiring on the reporter. So the reporter was PBS's Yamiche Alcindor. So she's asking about the influx of unaccompanied minors across the border. And this is what she said. This is a quote. The perception of you that got you elected as a moral, decent man is the reason why a lot of immigrants are coming to this country and entrusting you with unaccompanied minors. Okay, so I'm going to read that again. This is a quote from Yamiche Alcindor addressing President Biden. Quote, the perception of you that got you elected as a moral, decent man is the reason why a lot of immigrants are coming to this country and entrusting you with unaccompanied minors. That's first-class sweet talk, I must say. It's from the press, and they're clearly not concerned about having a reputation or developing a reputation for obsequiousness. The ironic part was that it backfired. Biden spurned this flattery because it conflicted with his explanation of the border crisis, which is not true, by the way. He repeatedly claimed that the border influx was nothing new, that it had happened over and over and over in the past, and therefore it had nothing to do with him or with his policies. He said it was because of the weather. It was because of conditions in home countries. All these other reasons, but not him. So he rejected this idea that people were coming because of him, even because he was a moral, decent man. He says, no, it's the weather. It's the home countries. It's not me. All right, so all in all, this was a terrible performance for the press. President Trump, you might imagine, watched it, and he was on Laura Ingraham's program on Fox News Thursday night. Quote, "They were strange questions," he said. Yes, they were. "It was like softballs, like you're throwing softballs." Well, of course it was. And these are from some of the same people who were throwing the hardest hardballs they could put together at Trump. And Trump concluded, this is what Trump said, "It's just a different world." I think you'd have to agree with it. It is indeed a different world. So, I want to talk about this libel suit against the New York Times from Project Veritas. Extremely interesting developments. Talk about it right after this word from ExpressVPN. Social media and big tech are infringing on freedom of expression in this country, and they're not going to stop. So the question is, what are you going to do in response? You could deactivate all of your social media accounts. That doesn't seem to be very productive, but here's an idea. Instead of letting big tech sites revoke your right to free speech, why not revoke their right to your data? That's why you should protect your online data by using ExpressVPN. Now, if you've ever wondered how free social media companies make all their money, well, they do it by tracking your searches, your video history, everything you click on, and then they sell that data. When you use ExpressVPN, you anonymize much of your online presence by hiding your IP address, and that makes your activity more difficult to trace and to sell to advertisers. Now, ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your data to protect you from eavesdroppers on your network. And the ExpressVPN app could not be easier to set up. You just tap one button on your phone, on your computer, and you are protected. So, go to expressvpn.com/Byron. By visiting my link, you'll get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN service for free. Again, that's expressvpn.com/Byron. expressvpn.com/Byron to protect your data today. Okay, we're back, and as promised, I'm going to talk about the Project Veritas libel suit against the New York Times. First of all, the big news is that a justice of the Supreme Court, the New York State Supreme Court, has allowed this libel suit to go forward. The Times, as you would expect, had asked the judge to throw out the suit. But he, in a 16-page opinion, he said that there was substantial basis in law to proceed and that Project Veritas, quote, is entitled to try to establish whether the New York Times writers were purposely and or recklessly inaccurate, sloppy, or something less. Okay, now that's extraordinary right there. The suit, let me tell you what the suit is about. It focuses on two articles that the New York Times published about Project Veritas. One was on September 29th, 2020, and it was headlined, quote here, "Project Veritas video was a, quote, coordinated disinformation campaign," end quote, researchers say. Okay, the reporter there was a woman named Maggie Astor. Now, about a month later, October 25th, 2020, there's an article headlined, "Conservative News Sites Fuel Voter Fraud Misinformation." These are kind of negative stories, as you seem to be probably getting that impression. That was by Tiffany Hsu, another New York Times reporter. Now, they focused on a video that Project Veritas had made that, I'm going to quote their description of it, reported on illegal voting practices taking place in Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's congressional district and specifically within the Somali-American community of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Okay. Now, Project Veritas had a number of objections to the stories, but the most simple one, one I'm going to focus on here, is the description of the video as deceptive. That's the word they use, deceptive. Indeed, the very first sentence of the Astor story, the Maggie Astor story, began, quote, "A deceptive video released on Sunday by the conservative activist James O'Keefe." Okay. The story by Tiffany Hsu included a sentence that said, "The Fox News host Sean Hannity and conservative publications magnified the reach of a deceptive video released last month by Project Veritas." Okay, so Project Veritas's position was this, reading from their lawsuit. "There was nothing deceptive about the Project investigative report, nor did Project Veritas selectively edit or doctor any of the interviews or recorded conversations therein." Now, what I'm going to do now is give you the thrust of the story, the Veritas story, and the way that they described it. Okay, so this is quoting from their lawsuit. "The centerpiece of the Project Veritas investigative report was a series of videos posted to Snapchat in early July 2020 by a Minneapolis man named Liban Mohammed. Mr. Mohammed, who is the brother of then Minneapolis City Council candidate Jamal Osman, filmed himself bragging about, quote, harvesting hundreds of absentee ballots from Minneapolis voters, a practice that is plainly illegal under Minnesota election law. In one video, Mr. Mohammed displayed a vast number of ballots littering his car's dashboard while boasting in Somali, quote, numbers don't lie. You can see my car here is full. All these here are absentee ballots. Can't you see? Look at the all these. My car is full." He also said, "And just today we got 300 for Jamal Osman." Now, in another video, Mr. Mohammed filmed himself exiting an apartment complex with his hand stuffed with ballots and boasting, quote, 2 in the morning, still hustling." So, that's what the video purported to show. Now, to win this lawsuit, Project Veritas has to prove not only that some part of the Times article was false and defamatory, but also that the Times published it with actual malice, which is defined in the law as, quote, "with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not." Okay. What I thought was extraordinary about this story was the conversation that ensued between the Times lawyers, between the Project Veritas lawyers, and between Judge Charles Wood, the Justice of the State Supreme Court in New York. Here's what's remarkable. The Times' defense was that Astor and Hsu, who are both news reporters, freely injected opinion into their reports. Now, even though the stories were published in the news section of the paper, Project Veritas was not entitled to sue for libel because opinions are, quote, unverifiable. So this is what the Times said in its motion to dismiss the case. "Unverifiable expressions of opinion are not actionable and cannot be defamatory. A defamation action must be based on statements of objective fact, not on an expression of opinion, which by definition cannot be true or false. In this politically charged context, the term, quote, deceptive is not susceptible to an objective meaning and is therefore a non-actionable opinion." At another point, they called deceptive, the word deceptive, non-actionable, pure opinion. That's really remarkable. This is a news story. It's not on the op-ed page. It's not by the editorial board. It's a news story in the New York Times. Okay. In other passages of the defense, the Times lawyers argued that the use of deceptive was either substantially true, maybe it was deceptive, do not have a defamatory meaning, or, again, are non-actionable statements of opinion. Whatever the case, they said, throw this lawsuit out. Okay, the Times had to back up its position. They had to show why it was either substantially true or not defamatory or non-actionable to use the word deceptive to describe the project videos. Its efforts to do so were just nothing less than embarrassing. Early on in the suit, the Times relied on the authority of Wikipedia. Yes, Wikipedia, to support its use of deceptive to describe the Project Veritas video. Here's what the Times wrote, the lawyers wrote. Very expensive lawyers, I'm sure. Project Veritas is described on its Wikipedia page, and just about everywhere else, as an American far-right activist group founded by James O'Keefe that uses undercover techniques to reveal supposed liberal bias and corruption and is known for producing deceptively edited videos about media organizations, left-leaning groups, and debunked conspiracy theories. This is from the Times. If the anonymous authors at Wikipedia say that Project Veritas's work is deceptive, well, then it's got to be true. So the next thing they said, and this is reading again from the lawsuit, a simple Google search for Project Veritas and deceptively edited videos yields about 166,000 matches. Now, who could doubt? Who could doubt the authority of a Google search? Now, actually, I did the Google search. I searched for Project Veritas and deceptively edited videos, and it did get a bunch of hits, about 166,000. Look at the ones at the top. The top one was the Wikipedia page. A bit of circularity there in the Times argument. But then early on, high up, were articles from the Huffington Post, from the Daily Beast, from Media Matters. Media Matters. These are some of the authorities upon which the distinguished lawyers at the New York Times are basing their defense. Now, most of these stories that were cited by the Times claim that other Project Veritas videos were deceptive. They weren't about the Minneapolis video. But the Times did point to some sources who purported to say that the actual video involved in the lawsuit was deceptive. Now, those sources included a local TV station in Minneapolis and also an article in Forbes. An article in Forbes that said Project Veritas did deceptive videos. The story in Forbes devoted 48 words to Project Veritas. None of them were based on any reporting. And then finally, there was a report from, quote, prominent researchers from Stanford and the University of Washington who, quote, this is the Times' words, speculated that the timing of the video's release suggested that it might have been part of a coordinated disinformation campaign. So this is the Times citing speculation as proof that its reporters were accurate in describing this video as deceptive. Now, the point of the Times defense was that the papers were relying on this mishmash of information when they declared the Project Veritas video to be, quote, deceptive. I'll read again from the Times defense here. The reporters believed their stories to be true, and at the time they published the articles, knew of Project Veritas's reputation for selectively editing videos, of the widespread criticisms of the video, and of the excellent reputations of the independent news outlets, 48 words in Forbes, fact-checkers and researchers that agreed with the assessment. Okay, that's what the lawyer said. Now, the reporters had no reason not to believe what the Huffington Post or Forbes had said. This is the Times argument. So they just passed it off as their own conclusion. Now, is that the way it's supposed to work? I mean, what about doing some reporting of their own to assess the deceptiveness or lack of deceptiveness of the video? That was not necessary, the Times lawyers said. Reading you again. Project Veritas also alleges that defendants fail to investigate further by seeking comment from Project Veritas or the individuals in the video. Okay, that's what the Times said. Quote, but it is well established that failing to investigate or verify statements does not, as a matter of law, establish actual malice. The Times said that even an extreme departure from professional standards does not establish actual malice. So in other words, they just passed this stuff off as fact. They didn't check it out, but that's okay. And then they hit one more argument. They said there have been so many attacks on Project Veritas, which is true. If you follow media, you're certainly aware of them. There have been so many attacks that Project Veritas has no reputation to defame. It's impossible to defame. This is relying on some law in some mafia cases in which mafia dons or figures were so bad that it's impossible to really lower their reputation. The Times cited a completely unrelated case in which the judge wrote, there are persons so notorious that they have insufficient reputation on which to base a defamation lawsuit. Their suits are necessarily frivolous. They are said to be libel-proof. The New York Times said Project Veritas is a libel-proof plaintiff. They can't be libeled, so we didn't libel. So that is the argument. That is the argument the New York Times made in its defense. Now, the judge did not agree here. In particular, he objected to the Times' argument that the news reports were based in part on opinion. The New York Times ethics policies, the judge wrote, quote, prohibit news reporters from injecting their subjective opinions into news stories published by the New York Times. Upon review of the total context and tone of the stories, which clearly disparage Project Veritas and the video, the court concludes that a reasonable reader could very well believe that the challenged statements were conveying facts about Project Veritas. The article certainly could be viewed as being purposely designed to appear that the Times is imparting facts and evidence that Project Veritas videos were deceptive. Of course they were. I mean, it's obvious. Okay, the judge was also not impressed by those very impressive sources that the Times cited. These sources resoundingly describe Project Veritas as partisan zealots with a history of distorting facts or context, running cons, misleadingly editing video, and being known for deceptively edited videos. While this is a lengthy media list, polling does not decide truth, nor speak to evidence, and defendants have not met their burden to prove that the reporting by Project Veritas in the video is deceptive. So, Judge Wood denied the Times' motion to dismiss the case. Now it goes forward. The court finds that the documentary proof and the facts alleged by Project Veritas are sufficient to meet its burden, the judge wrote. The facts submitted by Veritas could indicate more than standard garden variety media bias and support a plausible inference of actual malice. There is substantial basis in law to proceed. So that's a very, very big deal. That means that the case can go to discovery, that Project Veritas can get all sorts of evidence of the internal workings of the New York Times. Doesn't mean they're going to win. It's very, very hard to win a libel case. But the judge's analysis does not sound good for the Times. And now you're going to have a grueling period of discovery. So I'm going to read you something that Jonathan Turley, the George Washington University law professor, said. Judge Wood's opinion, quote, could prove a critical shot across the bow for many in the media that the blurring of opinion and fact could come at a high price. Indeed, it could. So we'll see what happens in this case. We'll keep an eye on this case. But it's an extraordinary development, and you should know about it. So that's it for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Sorry about the raspiness in my voice, but I hope you'll join us again soon for another edition of the Byron York Show.